Thanks very much, Jennifer. Good afternoon, everyone. So it's my job today to give you the public health perspective on biomass, smoke, air pollution and human health, particularly that concerning fires, and also to explain why it's such a crucial issue for pyrogeographers to understand. And I'll start with basics, because I recognise that epidemiologists and other scientists may speak a different language, so I'll just explain what I'm talking about and what I mean when I use various words. But when I use the term biomass smoke, I'm meaning all the emissions that are generated by burning biodegradable organic matter, which can be forest fires, peat fires, and also fires that are used for domestic cooking and heating, burning wood indoors and dung and such like, would all come under the term biomass smoke. And from a very simplistic epidemiological perspective, it contains, as you know, hundreds of chemicals, but CO2 and particulate matter are the big ones from our point of view, and numerous toxic co-pollutants. And I probably don't need to list them to you, but ozone, carbon monoxide, organic, acids, inorganic acids, most of which have been shown in various studies to be harmful to health as well. So really, when we're talking about nearly all the epidemiological studies have been done on particulate matter, and we need to recognise it's probably a proxy, it has effects in itself, but it also is a marker for that whole mix that is biomass smoke, or in the case of burning fossil fuels or petrol, it's that mix that comes from the substrate that's burnt. So when I talk about particulate matter, what I'm talking about is any small particle in the air, regardless of its size and regardless of its composition. It's a very amorphous general term that doesn't mean a lot specifically. And the reason for that is, for the purposes of epidemiology, it's very hard to do studies on anything more specific, particularly at huge population scales. But epidemiologists do try and do a little bit better than that and think about it in two ways, in size and in composition. And as far as size goes, there's three main groups used in health studies. So when I say PM10, I'm talking about particles with an aerodynamic diameter less than 10 microns or 10 microns or less. PM2.5, similarly, it's a subset of that, those particles that are 2.5 microns or less. And those that are less than 1 micron are termed ultrafines, ultrafine particles in the literature. The vast majority of literature actually centres around PM10, but as the realisation of the importance of size, and particularly the smaller size classes, there's more studies now addressing PM2.5 and ultrafines. The reason that size is important is basically anatomical particles, 10 microns or less, can get beyond your nose. Things like macroscopic bits of soot and pollen often get stuck in your nose. Things 10 microns or less can get down into your small airways. 2.5 microns and less get into the alveolar sacs, ultrafine particles enter the bloodstream and cells. So they have a different range of effects. And the belief is the smaller the particle, the more harmful it's likely to be. As far as composition goes, there's less good quality studies teasing out different particles one from the other. The very early studies or realisation in human health that particles were bad for you actually didn't come from carbon-based particles produced by combustion, either fossil fuel or biomass. It came from the mining industry with coal workers' pneumoconiosis, coal workers' lung, silicosis, asbestosis, those rather larger macroscopic crustal particles. But the vast majority of the literature now concerns urban air pollution and fossil fuel combustion, and most particles in these studies are carbon-based particles. Right, that's interesting. Well, that's why the effects overlap, I would guess. And, they're not pure particles either. They've got stuff stuck onto them. There's metals, there's pollens, there's all sorts of bits and pieces. Okay, so what do we know about particulate matter and human health? Just speaking generally first before I go through the specifics. The WHO did a huge study a few years back, the Global Burden of Disease Study, where they tried to figure out what was killing people on Earth, the rank order of importance. And they did that by disease, and then they did it by causes and environmental causes. So, of course, the most important environmental causes were unsafe drinking water, smoking cigarettes, inadequate food, protein, energy, malnutrition are the huge causes of preventable death on a worldwide basis. But the fact is particulate matter was up there in the top 10, well ahead of all sorts of other things like, motor accidents and that you might expect to find there. And the reason for that is that nearly everyone is exposed one way or another, because the vast majority of humans live in big cities. Big cities have industry and motor vehicles, so that's one enormous source. Those people that don't live in rural areas, often in low-income countries, and are dependent on burning biomass fuels indoors and get very high exposures that way. So one way or another affects nearly everyone on Earth. The vast majority of evidence, though, does come from urban studies. Particularly Europe and North America led the way with this. But more recently, studies have been replicated all around the place. Southeast Asia, Hong Kong, South America, Mexico. And they all are telling us the same thing. So what I'm about to tell you about the health effects of particulate, we can be very confident of. There is less evidence, although it's reasonable, about indoor biomass smoke. The studies are slightly different there. If you're examining outdoor air pollution in a big city, they're hard studies to do anyway. You've got outdoor monitors, you know, and they're proxies of exposure for millions of people. And of course, there's going to be spatial and regional variation in individual exposure. And you've got to get a proxy of a health outcome, which is hard as well. And often you're dependent on routinely collected administrative data sets. And often it depends on what country you're in, whether you have access to those. And that's the reason that North America and Europe were leaders in the field, because they were better able to get hold of hospital admissions data, mortality data. Whereas when I come to talk about Indonesia later and trying to assess the health effects of the huge fires there in 1997, it was a lot more difficult because the systematic data collections weren't in place in the same way. Indoor biomass smoke is a slightly different issue because you can measure individuals, you can measure inside their house, and you can follow them over time. So they're easier and harder. They're often harder because of the places you have to go to and the measurement is harder. But the quality of the study is often a lot higher because you're much more confident of the exposure levels that people get. But where the epidemiological blind spot is with outdoor biomass smoke, particularly that from fires, agricultural burning, and also outdoor biomass smoke that arises from burning wood in stoves to keep warm. And the reason for that is largely technical. It's partly the mindset of all the people studying air pollution in North America and Europe, that fires are somewhere else and not a problem and intermittent and, don't need the public health impact isn't necessarily perceived to be important. It's partly because when episodes happen, they're often unexpected, they're fire disasters, and all the resources go into the actual fire. And so setting up an epidemiological study is, difficult. They're nearly all done in retrospect, and that's difficult as well to get good quality data and a good quality study. There's a few places you can do them prospectively, and Darwin's one of them, which is how I got into this, because the burn-off is predictable there. The other point about biomass smoke, if it comes from wood heaters, is that in a big city, even if a lot of people burn wood, it might only be 20, 30, 40% of the total mix of particulate matter, and how do you apportion that? And there have been a few studies that have just come out in the last year, but only two or three that have tried to do that by using chemical markers. So if we see a lot of black carbon or if we see a lot of levoglucosan, that's often attributed to biomass burning, while other markers are used to attribute, petrol burning and diesel. So I should say the number of studies that specifically address fires and human health, you could count between 20 and 30. And about a third have come from Australia, a third from North America, and a third from Southeast Asia, with one or two others. Okay, so what are the human health effects? And I'll go through these one by one. They've been studied partly, I've talked mostly about the population health studies, but there's a range of studies, and the first studies that were done on animals and seeing what happened, just to give an idea of toxicity to mammals, really. They're less useful for population health impacts. And then the next stage on was deliberate exposure of healthy human volunteers in chamber studies. And it was those kind of studies that have elucidated the mechanisms through which particulate matter might cause ill health. So it's known now fairly clearly, both biomass and non-biomass derived particulates. There's only been one biomass chamber study where they, had a wood fire and pumped it into a room and had people in the room and take blood at regular intervals. And usually exposing people to levels that you would expect to be exposed to in the environment anyway. So it's not exposing to huge, huge levels. Of course, the other problem is they're healthy volunteers, and it's hard to know what that means for a population, because the populations aren't particularly healthy usually. So inflammation, coagulation and oxidative stress, what does that mean? Inflammation, I'm sure you're familiar with. If you twist an ankle, redness, swelling, it's part of the immune response. It's very useful. It helps promote healing and blood flow. If it happens in the wrong time and wrong place, it's harmful. You know, and diseases such as asthma, arthritis, and even heart attacks, because inflammation promotes coagulation of the blood. Again, that's useful if you've cut yourself, but if you have a blocked coronary artery and you inhale some particulate matter and it makes your blood just slightly more prone to coagulating, that will be the event that gives you your heart attack. And that's the reason that, in fact, probably there are more deaths from particulate matter from heart attacks than there are from lung conditions, which is a bit counterintuitive. Everyone associates air pollution with lungs, but it's equally, if not more so, important for hearts. Because of the underlying condition of our society, I should say, we're prone to heart disease, so it's one more insult. And then, as far as population studies go, mostly, as I said before, they've examined daily fluctuations in particulate matter, measured all around the city, with daily fluctuations in administrative data collections. And all of these have found associations with death rates, hospital admission rates, and exacerbation of symptoms. So what I mean by exacerbation of symptoms is they're frequently done as panel studies, but you get a group of several hundred people with asthma or with chronic lung disease, or elderly people with heart monitors on them, and you monitor what their heart does or what their symptoms do, what their need for medication is, whether they need to go to hospital. They keep a diary every single day. You monitor the particulates every single day, and then you see, and a whole lot of other things you think might confound the association, and then see what you come up with. So it's shown fairly clearly that chronic lung diseases will be exacerbated. That's asthma, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, those sort of conditions. Heart rate will become unstable, particularly in people prone to heart disease, with daily fluctuations even at fairly low levels of particulate matter. Admissions increase depending on the condition, but 1 to 2% for each rise in 10 micrograms per cubic metre of PM10. And mortality will increase, depending on the population you study, between 0.5% and 1% for every rise of 10 in PM10. I guess I should give you the context of what background levels of PM10 are in most cities. Australian cities are clean, our background levels are around 20. I note that around here, California, are often between 50 and 100. Australia's air quality guidelines and the WHO guidelines actually set a maximum 24-hour PM10 of 50. The USA still keep it at 150, which is extraordinarily high by Australian standards. But a lot of cities aren't at the stage where they can get the pollution levels down to where they are in other parts of the world, such as Europe. So a rise in 10 of PM10 is actually a fairly small rise. And when you're talking about large populations, the public health impact of that is quite big. Yeah. No. It's the relationships that have been well studied in terms of their concentration responses have all been linear. It's been very well studied for mortality. It's harder to study for exacerbations of conditions such as asthma because so many things influence asthma. And people treat themselves at home before they go to hospital, and you know, presentation to hospital might be non-linear for reasons such as that. And of course many other things affect asthma other than air pollution. But certainly for mortality, it's linear. Much higher. I don't know what, but I know it's you know, when visibility is affected, you know you're exceeding by a long way. But it's interesting, the motivation of these things to clean air. It's, you know, the Beijing government is acting on that for the sake of the Olympics. Yeah. Oxidative stress. Oh, sorry, I didn't mention that one. That's a byproduct of us being oxygen-dependent animals. We need oxygen, but then you get free radicals as the byproduct of that. And free radicals are very toxic and are well-known carcinogens. So we make them all the time as a product of respiration, and we clear them out, but if you inhale particulates, you get a whole lot more of them. So oxidative stress just means more exposure to free radicals. Okay, longer-term associations are similar, I'll have to say. They're harder to study. You have to follow thousands of people for decades. The first studies, and the major studies really have all come from the US, following, you know, people initially in six different cities, and then the American Cancer Study was many more thousands of people. The main point about long-term associations is the effect sizes seem to be greater. For a annual exposure level of PM10 that rises by 10 units, 10 micrograms per cubic metre. The increase in mortality, estimates vary from 6 to 10% for that. That's quite high. Perinatal mortality, similarly, the cot deaths and even fetal deaths are directly proportional to the level of PM in the air. And the people doing that study, in fact, didn't model below the minimum levels experienced in cities, but, you know, if you got it even down further, you would save more lives that way. Associated with birth weight and with lung cancer. And this has been shown both in city, big city studies and also in indoor biomass studies, very, very similar outcomes. So the relationships are generally believed to be linear where they've been examined. And that's, as I said before, that's very clear for mortality and probably true for illness, morbidity, but there's more work to be done there. There's no lower threshold below which this happens. You know, asthma and some others, there may be some threshold in some outcomes, but the general point is that it's linear with no lower threshold. We also know there's a lot of groups at much higher risk from air pollution. Female gender, being elderly, being very young, babies in particular, being socioeconomically disadvantaged and having multiple chronic diseases all increase your risk of getting ill from exposure to particulates. So you can imagine different societies and different health spectrums, what the effect will be with exposure to massive pollution from a fire, for example. We also know there's some genetic markers, but if some people have, they're going to be much more prone to getting the health effects of pollution. Interest, and they're genetic genes that code for protection against oxidative stress. I can't tell you what they are because it's not my area so much. There's a whole drug class called statins which are prescribed for lower blood lipids, but if you're on those statins and have those bad genes, you're protected from the effects of those genes. So that's, there's some biological mechanisms that are still being figured out. Okay, so I'm going to focus more on biomass now rather than particulates in general, and how the evidence in that domain relates to the evidence about particulates in general that I've just given you. And the message really is that it's consistent with the wider literature. There's absolutely nothing to suggest that it's any safer at all. Whatever the perception may be in some communities about nice natural woods and a nice smell and renewable wood, there's all sorts of perceptions about it, but it's no less harmful than particulates that come out of a car exhaust. I've talked about the limitations to the studies, why the evidence is limited. And there are some possible differences in the spectrum of ill health that they cause. But as I said, these are on the basis of very few studies. But certainly there seems to be a consistent signal that respiratory outcomes are in fact worse. That's from studies of wood smoke, reviews of studies of wood smoke that look at similar exposures and similar outcomes find a greater increase in ill health for the same amount of a rise of 10 of PM10 if the source is wood smoke or bushfire smoke. And we certainly found that in our work in Darwin, our colleague Jeff Morgan's work in Sydney, Joshua Mott's work in Southeast Asia, some work in Christchurch, New Zealand, where there's a lot of wood smoke, all seem to be giving that same signal. But for the other outcomes, heart disease and deaths, there's probably not enough studies to make a call. You know, it may not be so bad for cardiovascular, but it's really hard to call. Certainly we found significant associations in the indigenous population of Darwin with cardiovascular disease and heart attacks. But we didn't in the non-indigenous, so there's, you know, there's a different risk levels in those populations. And the few studies of deaths have found similar outcomes, both in adults and in neonates and fetal deaths. So why do we worry about it? I guess what's the public health meaning of all this? It's these reasons. It's probably the most important reason on a worldwide scale is domestic fuel use in low-income countries. And the WHO estimated that 2.4 billion, which is close to half our world's population, use biomass fuels for their cooking and heating. Some use it as open fires without any kind of ventilation, without any kind of chimney. Some use stoves. Some have fuel stoves with the chimney. It varies from region to region. And a lot of work has been done in many parts of the world, Central America, Northern India, Africa, to try and change, or even to just have a chimney to convert indoor pollution to outdoor pollution, because indoor levels of particulates can reach, there was one study with had a reading of something like 10,000, you know, micrograms, something enormous, something you would never experience in an outdoor setting. More often it's 700, but 700 is huge. And of course the people exposed are the women and the children and the young babies, you know, some of the most vulnerable people because they're indoors all day. So Azzati and others who did the global burden of disease study estimated that that alone is responsible for 1.6 million deaths annually. That's about 3% of premature deaths worldwide, just from that alone. Moving on to fires, the reason for being interested is, I mean, increasing fires for whatever reason. Severe fires are increasing. Deliberate burns and attempts to respond to these are increasing, which means population exposure is increasing. Interestingly enough, wood heater use is increasing in high-income countries, North America, Scandinavia, parts of Australia. And that's thought to be a response to rising fossil fuel prices and the perception it's renewable in these times, you can regrow more trees. So the contribution of biomass smoke to ambient air in high-income countries is also increasing. Okay, so now I'm going to focus on fires rather than biomass smoke in general and talk about health effects that you might expect to see from fires. And I'm dividing it into two, the effects of the fire and the fire front and the effects of the smoke. And effects of the fire are obvious to everyone because it makes news and people know what goes on, but there's deaths and injuries from firefighters, from people in their houses, you know, smoke toxicity from inhaling huge quantities of smoke at the time. And then loss of housing, loss of infrastructure, the social disruption that goes along with that. And I don't want to minimise these impacts. They're huge, and the few psychiatric studies that have been done have shown that people who lost houses or were affected, you know, at the fire front carry long-term mental health illness, particularly post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. And that's... there's not many studies, I guess, but the studies that have been done have all come to that same conclusion. So being exposed to a fire isn't fun, but I guess what I'm about to argue is that it's actually, from a public health perspective, it's the effect of the smoke that is of greater importance, even though it's less obvious. And the reasons for that is that fires can be big and the pollution can just be massive. You know, it's vast tons of carbon being vented, you know, that have been laid down and grown over years. In a matter of 24 hours is up there in the sky. It gets transported long distances and it can go over cities and affect huge populations. And depending on where you are in the world, those populations can be at high risk, but any population is at risk. There's no safe lower threshold, and when you're talking about pushing the PM10 over and above, you know, 200 or 300, you're talking, even if it's for a day or so, you're going to have fairly important health effects from that. So the magnitude of health effects, when I'm talking about 1% per rise in PM10, are small, but the public health impact is important because of the vast numbers of people exposed. And so the question then arises, what does this cost and what does this mean? Because the fire, you know, the publicity and the outrage and community outrage surrounding fires is rarely about the smoke at the time, which is interesting because it's different from perceptions of prescribed burns, where the outrage is nearly always about the smoke. But if you want to put that into the perspective of what it costs to fight fires and have fires, surprisingly not many studies have done that, but I've found two and I'll show you about them. But the economic costs of health effects of smoke from fires may be the single biggest economic cost of fires per se, depending on where the smoke goes and how many people are affected, but I'll give you two examples. The first came from Indonesia in 1997, and I'll go through that figure with you. That was the year, as you know, there were huge fires, 97, 98, in Southeast Asia. And soon after that, Glover and Jessop edited a book that tried to examine the economic cost, particularly for Indonesia. And the figure there shows in purple, there's yellow and purple bars. Ignore the yellow. Yellow is not Indonesia, and I'll just talk about Indonesia for the moment. So these darker coloured bars here give estimates of the cost in US millions of dollars. So this here is 500 million, 1,000 million, and then it goes up to 4,500 million. And along the bottom, they did their best to make estimates for cost to agriculture, biodiversity, carbon release, direct and indirect forest benefits, firefighting costs, short-term health costs, timber costs, tourism costs, other. And then this big one at the end is actually the total, adding them all up. And the short-term health costs they've got here, this bar here, which they've put at about $1,000 million, and not, you know, just under the, I'm not quite sure what they meant by indirect forest benefits, actually. Which is actually relatively small when you consider what I was saying about the health effects of, thanks, that's a big finish. But this was done 10 years ago. The state of air pollution epidemiology has come a long way since then. And even though studies of biomass and fires in particular hadn't happened, when the book got reprinted in 2006, they didn't re-estimate any of the health costs, but they did acknowledge that this estimate must have been a major, major underestimate. It basically calculated the cost of increased healthcare attendances to hospitals throughout Indonesia. So it made some estimates of what that might be, particularly for respiratory conditions. It didn't include deaths, and it didn't include the loss of productivity that comes with, you know, being disabled by having your lung conditions worse and kids having to stay home and parents caring for their kids. More recently, a paper's come out by Jayachandran, UCLA, in 2005, who tried to estimate the impact on perinatal and fetal deaths in Indonesia. And they did it by estimating, there's good data on births every year in Indonesia, and they estimated exposure by using satellite data to see which regions were effective and affected by the haze and for what period. And then they looked at the annual census of births and figured out the amount of births that were missing due to that haze at that particular time. So there were dips in particular regions that were affected by smoke haze. And they came to the conclusion that, in fact, Indonesia's entire birth cohort was reduced by 1% due to that fire event that just lasted a few months. So that's 16,400 infant and fetal deaths. And if you then try and put that in economic terms, and this isn't even the adult deaths, they came to the conclusion. Don't think I can turn it on. But here they've estimated $1,000 million, which is about $1 billion. If you factor in the cost of deaths, and particularly loss of a young life, you're talking about $16 billion. You're talking 16 of these. And that's just death. So when you look at it that way, you know, the rest is nothing. And that was a big fire in extreme levels, but that's... I'll move on to the second example now, which is a North American example from Canada. And this was a team who estimated the health costs in context with all the other costs of a fire in Alberta. And they did some very good modelling, very detailed modelling. They used the best known effect estimates of PM2.5, which at that stage was the best one to use. 1.1 million people were exposed, so it was two cities that added up to 1 million people. And they were, although the fire burnt for 7 days, they were only exposed for 1 day. So it's not a huge amount of people compared to Indonesia. It's only 1 day. The PM10 in that fire, I think, went up to about 150, 160. It wasn't huge. The PM2.5 was around 75 to 80. So we're not talking a huge exposure and we're not talking a long exposure. And we're talking a healthy community, you know, compared with Indonesia. And what they found was that the health costs, they, by doing two different sorts of estimations, they put between 10 and 12 million for that 1 day. And that's because they included mortality. And even if that was only one death, it was still puts the economic costs of the exposure to smoke, you know, off the dial. And they compared that with loss of... They didn't actually quantify the 75 buildings, but the bridges, the loss of electrical infrastructure, power lines, the firefighting costs that went for 7 days, which cost $10 million. And it was a timber plantation, and they lost a huge amount of that, and that was $20 million. So it was high. It wasn't the biggest, but it was just 1 day. You know, had the wind been different and the smoke been there for 2 days, you could say $20 million. You know, if it had gone for a whole week, it would have been the biggest cost of that particular fire. Okay, so just briefly bringing us back to fires, health and climate change, which is more of a focus of this meeting. Speaking in more general terms, the reason why I see this as important is increasing fires, increasing pollution for a number of reasons. And the direct health and economic and social cost of that I've touched upon already. But I just want to acknowledge all the other, you know, it's not a direct health fire thing, there's all sorts of interactions, and fires affect water quality. Melbourne in Australia came dangerously close to losing its water supply after the fires last year because of runoff and pollution of the water following a fire. And then there's all the interactions that I'm learning about between fires and climate and carbon and the water balance. And of course, as the climate changes, that's going to have a whole lot of health effects that are anticipated, some that we're seeing already. And I won't go into them too much now, but I'm sure you're familiar with the scenarios. And of course, of all these things, heat waves, interestingly, one thing I didn't say about pollution is there's a phenomenon that epidemiologists call harvesting. And it's sort of harvesting for St. Peter. It refers to if people are on the brink of death and you get an episode of some sort and it brings their death forward by a day or something. They're about to die anyway. They've got an insult, they die. And if you plot deaths, you see the peak due to the insult, whatever it may be, and then you see a corresponding dip. With air pollution, you don't see that. So it's not thought to be harvesting. They've done distributed lag modelling for months on end. They haven't found any corresponding dip. So it's genuine premature life lost. With extreme heat events and heat waves, on the other hand, it often exhibits that harvesting phenomena. And it may be less of an issue than it would be otherwise. There's also benefits. Cold-related deaths aren't harvesting. You know, there could be some benefits in not having so many severe cold days. Cold is actually much more harmful than the heat, depending on how hot you get, of course. Okay. So I'll finish just by discussing how pyrogeographers and others can think about health issues in terms of fires. And I was going to comment, because the world has so many different fire-prone regions and scenarios and societies, I was going to divide my comments into what I'm calling fire-prone regions, you know, such as what I'm familiar with in Australia, both in the tropics and in the more temperate regions, and then in tropical rainforest areas that we've been hearing about from Southeast Asia and South America. So first, to talk about tropical savannas, which is where I first started studying the health effects of fires. Places like that have always been burnt by humans for as long as anyone knows, and still are being burnt by humans. There's fire regimes that have been going, you know, since humans have been there. What I learnt when I worked there and worked with David, and who looked at the ecology and land use and fire regimes, we learnt that even at incredibly low levels of particulate matter, well under Australia's stringent air quality standard of 50, that when the particulate levels rose even above 40, you would see doubling in hospital presentations for asthma. And then by looking at how the land was managed, we could see that those events came from regions of the savannas that weren't actually actively being managed at that time. The huge savannas surrounding Darwin, you can sort of think of as divided into three groups. As far as land management goes, there's areas of Arnhem Land, some of which were depopulated in the 1950s and Aboriginal people got moved to various settlements, so some of Arnhem Land is populated, some isn't. And then there's areas largely managed by non-Indigenous people, Kakadu National Park and mango plantations and such like around Darwin. So you've got the non-Indigenous management, you've got Indigenous management who's sort of doing what usually has been done, and then a big, big area that hasn't really been managed for fire since the 50s. The huge fire events, or smoke events, that sent people to hospital came from the unmanaged areas. The other peak in pollution, which was often early in the dry season, as soon as the rains had stopped, came from non-Indigenous management. It was everyone madly getting in there to do their fuel reduction burning all at once, another big wave of pollution that came over Darwin. And then when the ecological studies were done, those areas in fact had much higher fuel loads, much more grass fire, fireweeds, that was probably being promoted by this desire to burn 50% of Kakadu. It's a vast area and hundreds of kilometres gets burnt annually. So, you know, and then you can look across the river, the East Alligator River, to Arnhem Land that's managed by Aboriginal people. You can actually just look and see the different fuel loads. Arnhem Land, Aboriginal people, the most impoverished segment of Australian society, just living, doing what they're doing, but protecting the health of people in Darwin. They had the lowest emissions of anyone, lowest fuel loads, lowest harm to the environment and to human health. So that was an interesting lesson for me in how land management affects pollution and how you've got to think about your regime and what regime is going to pollute the least. But I think also in the tropical savannas that burn and have regimes like this, it's relatively easy. And I'm now living in southern, more temperate parts of Australia, where it's a lot more politicised. When the fires come, they're huge, big disasters. People get outraged by them, and then they also get outraged by the efforts to prevent them in terms of prescribed burning. And so there are a lot of contradictory demands on people who manage landscapes. And I'm often in the position where I'm asked to comment on the health effects of prescribed burns, and should they go ahead and should they not go ahead, and what's the relative harm and risk from all these things. And it's complicated, because when there's a big fire, the attention isn't on the smoke. And it's classic in public health. You get taught about risk perception and risk communication and what means a lot to people and what doesn't mean a lot to people, and where it's an act of God beyond their control, and people are, you know, dying in their houses, and, you know, you don't want to be a wimp in Melbourne complaining that you've got smoky air. That's not what's perceived to be the most important thing at the time. On the other hand, when other government agencies you don't trust are deliberately lighting fires and it's affecting you and annoying you, even though the levels of particulates are an order of magnitude lower and much briefer, there's a lot more concern about it. And I'll give you an example of that, which might horrify you, but just a few weeks before we came here from Hobart was the burn-off season in Hobart for forestry burn-offs and fuel reduction burning. It was autumn. It was the one safe window to burn. And Hobart, and everyone did it all at once, and Hobart got covered in a smoke haze. It was very obvious. You couldn't see the hills. And there was community outrage, and people wanted to stop forestry because of all these greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, I was having to comment in the paper about what it all meant. You know, and there's very good evidence, part of it generated by myself, about these very low levels of particulates, you know, even at 20 and 30, do cause exacerbations of asthma, do, you know, keep people up all night worrying about their children, you know, do stop them going to work. It's quite real for those at risk. You know, and then it went away after a week. But the punchline of all this is, I don't know if one of you want to guess what the PM10 actually rose to during that haze that lasted a week. 40. Okay, it didn't breach Australia's air quality guidelines. I don't think it even got to what we're experiencing here today at Santa Barbara. So it's all about perception. But it's, you know, there's real evidence, there's real concern. It's not in people's heads that they're unwell. And it's a case, you know, of... I often use the analogy of immunisations if you want to have a public health intervention of some sort. The evidence for immunisations in terms of protecting the health of the population is overwhelmingly huge. There is absolutely no doubt that it's a really good thing to do to protect your society. You know, but doctors in the 50s were very arrogant. Do this, we know it's right, do it for you. And we're ignoring concerns, and there's still concerns about it because it's imposed by others. And, you know, and as a doctor, I've had to talk to parents whose, you know, a kid had an immunisation, they had a fever, they had a fit. What does that mean? Are they going to get epilepsy? Is it a, you know, public health things come with costs. Some kids have an overwhelming allergic reaction and die. You know, that's a huge cost. You can't, as the public health person wanting to do an intervention, say, don't be silly, it's just a nuisance. Of course, you've got to go along with it. We know best. And I think land managers have a lot to learn in that regard, because there's, if you're going to deliberately expose people to something you know is toxic, there's good evidence for it being toxic. You have to know what the risk is. You have to know what the risk of not doing it is. And you have to know what the benefit of doing it is and what the risk. And so I guess that's my question to you, particularly the fire ecologists amongst you, is the evidence of effectiveness. We're going to have fire regimes. The landscape's going to burn anyway. You know, how much can you avert wildfires? How much can you justify deliberately exposing people? Yeah. Yes. And wildfires like measles, the wild disease, yeah.
What's the,
how many land managers have measured the PM of their prescribed burns and know what? Yeah. Well, that was the... I mean, we have to learn to live with fire. We have to know the land well enough to know how to minimise. Like, my suggestion would be to figure out where that spot is where you actually minimise total emissions and protect the public. I was interested in our discussion the other day when we talked about adapting and being prepared to live with fire. And the comments at the Times were, better houses, which are all quite true, insurance, thinking about where we live. But what was going on in my head, because, from my perspective, that's not the bigger part of it. It's clean air shelters, air conditioners, HEPA filters in nursing homes. It's planning for evacuation for short term. That's how we're really going to adapt to intermittent smoke events. And we're in a situation where you can. Yeah. The longer term impacts tend to be greater than the shorter term impacts. But prescribed burns aren't really long term exposure. That's the thing. It's intermittent, it's here and there. It's not every day, it's not like you're burning indoor. So even though there may be more days of a prescribed burn, it's still not really long term exposure. Unless the Darwin, the burn off, when it's chronic exposure over months. But the public health impact of huge burn, wildfires is enormous. It's deaths. It's deaths of children. It's, undoubtedly that's way worse than a prescribed burn that might make some people's asthma worse. And, if you did it for enough days or it affected Sydney, you might record a death. But you're unlikely to. Depending on the kind of filter within them. They do modify it a bit, they do improve indoor air a bit, but you need air conditioners that have a HEPA filter, high air efficiency particle filter, if you can afford it. Which you can in first world countries. I must say a lot of standard air conditioners in Australia come with that. A lot of nightclubs have it, a lot of offices have it, there's, for first world countries it's plausible. Yeah. Well, if you talk to economists, though, years of life, and these are babies, these are whole lives. Yeah. Yeah. Well, don't burn down your forests. Yeah. There's all sorts of ways you can, yeah.
I think one of the issues of health effects, for me, the most important thing to look at that is Africa. Mm-hmm. Even in Brazil, with 600 micrograms per kilo, there are about 20 million people in Amazonia, of which about 3 to 5 million are really exposed. But in Africa, it's hundreds of millions of people, in Nigeria, in very heavy polluted and very high population density. So actually, I think this effect would be extremely...
From fires you're talking about?
Fires in Africa.
Okay. Well, the average lifespan is already so low that it's changing for some. For some countries. And the capacity to change the burning would also, what can you do about it, is the other issue. I have never advocated switching fire off in fire-prone environments. And I never would, because you can't. It's mad. It's silly. That's why I'm talking about regimes that might minimise emissions, but they may be well above 40 or 50. But if you don't minimise them... But that's your job. You're the fire ecologist. Well, I gave you the example in the Northern Territory. That's a fairly clear one. I think it's a lot harder elsewhere. and it's not my specific expertise. But there's plenty of people whose expertise it is, whose whole job it is. I think they have a responsibility to think about these things. I think the biggest public health issue is not so much fire-prone landscapes in Australia and North America and developed countries. It's where we're converting massive forest conversion, massive fires, and huge populations of people affected year after year after year. That's the public health disaster, in my way of thinking. You know, it's something... But it's something that I was going to say is governments usually bear the brunt of the health costs. You know, and they respond to that in Australia by, you know, and in North America with air quality guidelines, and, you know, and then that makes it, you know, how well they understand what the ecological issues are, is that requires communication and negotiation. But the most inspiring example of how the health can be used was Ramanathan, who's worked a lot on aerosols in the Asian brown cloud and climatic effects of that, has set up an intervention in northern India with biomass fuel, so it's not so much the burning from fires, it's cooking fires. But he's been able to set up with local government a health intervention where they're in a huge, huge region, they're converting, giving everyone stoves, either solar, I think, or gas, but ones that don't give off the same amounts of carbon. They're doing it as a health intervention. He's going to be monitoring it by flying planes through the Asian brown cloud to see what improvements or changes that has on the regional climate. Because health and economics are what motivates government, and to a certain extent people, depending on how they're constrained and their other priorities in their environment. And I think that's an inspiring example of how you can take this forward. You know, it'll be different issues with forest fires, and it'll be different in each region. But, you know, an economic analysis of the impact of the South American fires year after year would be very interesting. Yeah. It's hard. It has been hypothesised, and someone did try to do a study actually, and they compared different cultural ethnic groups, you know, some of whom spent many years evolving near the equators and far from the equators, and made the assumption that those in cold places had greater exposure and now have greater rates of lung cancer with similar propagation. It's a very, and that caused a lot of debate in the epidemiological community. It's very hard to say. The studies that have been done in places in Africa, and well, not in Africa, but in Indonesia, where people are exposed quite regularly, aren't particularly reassuring. There's no difference you can see now for that sort of thing. I mean, there's genetic markers, and maybe there's a higher rate of those genes that protect you against oxidative stress, which is a big cause of lung cancer from biomass smoke. And it's plausible, but I don't think it's of public health relevance in how we try and approach this. That's right. Australian Aboriginal people do that as well. They'll build a platform and a fire underneath and sleep right above it for the same. Yeah, it irritates all of those things and correlates with, you know, with sales of products for hay fever, for example, with shown. Irritates all mucous membranes, even at very low levels. Yep. Certainly significantly higher rates of some cancers. Rates of chronic lung disease less so, but their exposure is more intermittent. But they do, and that's more in urban firefighters. Because urban firefighters, you know, all sorts of nasty toxic things burn, and they get exposed to more than just carbon-based particulates. So I couldn't find any studies that were just rural firefighters. And also firefighters, they're a healthy group as well. They're not typical. Well, there are actually some Egyptian mummies have got anthracotic lungs, meaning lungs full of black carbon, And there was a hypothesised reason for that, but I think it was indoor cooking. In the Roman times, people used to take each other to court over burning fires affecting neighbours, and that was a point of contention. That's yeah, well, lungs would be the place you'd see it. That's the big filter, yeah. No, not directly. No. Anemia affects your ability to carry oxygen, and exposure to carbon monoxide is much more severe if you're anemic. But there's not so much the link to oxidative stress. Okay, I finished, if that was my last slide.